Welcome to Bibliocracy, KPFK's weekly literary arts program. I'm your host, Andrew Tonkovich. Tonight, another in an occasional series of special shows featuring complete, read-in-one-sitting work from local authors. Greg Bills is the author of two novels, Consider This Home and Fearful Symmetry. Consider This Home, his debut, was lauded by playwright Tony Kushner as a wonderful, exciting novel, fierce, smart, observant, and at times very sexy. The book was a Literary Guild alternate selection. His work has also appeared in Fairy Tale Review and Santa Monica Review. Greg Bills lives in Los Angeles and teaches creative writing at the University of Redlands. Now reading for you an excerpt from his novel, Wait Here, a radio mix from a chapter titled Naomi Steinman, Not Even a Pronoun. Here's novelist Greg Bills.
There was this girl outside the patio at House of Pies, very pale, very young. It would have surprised Naomi to learn she was much more than a freshman in high school. She was a slip of a thing, in a navy greatcoat, in August, that drowned her. From Naomi's side of the table, she had been able to follow the girl's progress up the sidewalk along Vermont Avenue. It would be a mistake to say that this girl was doing anything so simple as walking up the street. She bobbed and weaved. Drugs, Naomi imagined. Most irritating of all, perhaps because Naomi and her friends were of a generation that had learned to value a dollar, the girl was trailed by the belt of her coat, its buckle dragging and snagging on the rippled cement. The girl was young, but she should have sense enough to take care of her clothes, even if, as seemed likely, she had filched that coat from the Goodwill. When the girl had come close enough to be visible, directly outside the partition around the restaurant patio, Naomi saw that the girl's hair was dyed black and her face was smudged. None too clean, she thought, which was no surprise. Then she realized the sooty marks were tattoos. The girl had gotten her face printed along the jawbone with black roses and thorns. Where were her parents? It was a question that often occurred to Naomi when she ventured out of the house these days. Whenever she went to the market or out for breakfast with her friends, she found herself surrounded by young people in states of undress and inked up like sailors, and these were the ladies. Where were their parents? The only sense these kids had was jingling in their pockets, and the same must go for their folks. Naomi, Mimi when she was with the girls, and Kiki and Sandy had moved their weekly date from lunch to breakfast to avoid the worst of these drunken monsters. "Well," said Kiki from across the table, "she's no better than she ought to be." She must have spotted the girl at last. Sandy laughed. "My mother used to say that." "Really?" Kiki quit staring at the tattooed girl and smiled at Sandy. "Was that a family saying?" "You mean a Japanese saying? No, I don't think so. I think she learned it from the radio." Sandy lifted her mug of tea to her lips, and Naomi watched her friend's thin arm shake down to the elbow. With palsy. Something. "I think it's a shame," Naomi inserted, returning the conversation to the girl. "Where are her parents, I'd like to know?" Naomi glanced over the table in time to catch Kiki exchanging a look with Sandy, who was seated at Naomi's left. She could read that look. She could. Like a headline in the newspaper, "Look to your own, Naomi Steinman." And what Sandy said had confirmed it. Sometimes, Mimi, you can't stop them. "It's not the silly fashions or the horrible cheap dyed hair. It's those tattoos. I would like to stand that girl in front of a mirror and say, 'What are your grandkids going to think of those pictures on your face when you're as wrinkled as me?'" "I'd like to see you do that," Kiki said. She had taken out a pocket mirror and started fixing her coral lipstick, though it was clear she hadn't finished eating yet. "Did Frank or Gabe have tattoos?" "Artie has an eagle on his chest. Not that you would know with all that hair." Stooped and nearly blind as Artie was, Kiki was always quick to tell them how her husband was all man. Naomi shook her head. But in fact, Gabe did have a tattoo that he got in the Navy during the war. She had been the only one privileged to see it. In public, he never again wore a shirt with sleeves that didn't reach at least to his elbows. Although she had assured him that people would understand, he had been firm. "Jews don't get tattoos." Naomi wondered if their son even knew Gabe Sr. had a snake and anchor on his arm. Gabe was really that secretive, and to honor his wishes even at this late date, she let her husband keep his picture to himself. "Not Frank either," Sandy agreed. "He always said they were only for gangsters." "For Artie, it was the war," Kiki explained. "But I guess for Frank..." Sometimes they, Naomi and Kiki, forgot that Sandy and Frank's war was very different from theirs. The two gals had finished high school and stayed home with their families, doing their bit for the effort by volunteering at the hospital and dancing with soldiers at the canteen. But Sandy, in their junior year, had been relocated with her family to the Santa Anita racetrack, then to Poston, a camp in the Arizona desert. That was where she met Frank. Sandy was perfectly willing to talk about those years, but the topic did feel uncomfortable. Naomi felt she should smooth things over. "Say," she began a bit too brightly, "did you see Rhonda Penbaker died?" Kiki nodded. "Saw the obituary." Sandy jittered tea to her mouth again. "Wait, she was who?" Kiki clarified. "David Penbaker's sister, 2 years ahead of us. I was on yearbook with her." "But my point," Naomi jumped in to steer them away again from high school, those years, "is that she married Carl Prentice, his first wife." Carl Prentice had owned the dry cleaners 2 doors down the street from the Nakamura nursery. "I never thought I'd see her name again, but there it was in the paper." "Oh, you hated her." Kiki shook a hand in the air. "Now, I didn't. She gave you no end of grief when you dated David, didn't think you were good enough for him." "I don't remember that. And you were Jewish. Kiki, that was never." "So hoity-toity, the Penbakers. I mean, I never heard the end of it on your book. She seemed to think I could influence you, to see it her way." Naomi turned to Sandy. "I knew none of this, I swear." "Of course, I spared you the whole sad story then. What would be the point?" "Thanks, Kiki." Naomi aimed for keeping it light. She was hurt, though, like an itch somewhere. Hurt that Kiki had kept the details back, or that Rhonda Penbaker had been so nice to her face all those years ago. "And what finally happened to David?" This was Kiki's predictable way of asking how someone died. "Prostate, I think. No, heart disease." "Not that it matters. We're all dropping like flies." Something about this little conversation, not any different really from last week or the week before that, depressed Naomi. It really was all obituaries and unfixed potholes at the corner and girls with tattoos. "Oh," Sandy touched her arm. "I meant to say, I saw the article in the calendar section about the band." Sandy smiled, but her stumble at the end was telling, and they all knew it. What could Sandy, what could anyone, say that wouldn't seem insulting or at least confusing when Naomi's son had left them no choices, not even a pronoun that didn't require constant explaining? Even the name of her son's band was embarrassing. She dreaded, in fact she hated, that every conversation she had now was full of stutters and grasping for words and awkward apologies. She thought it would get easier, or she would get used to it, but it didn't, and she hadn't. Why would she want to get used to it? "Me too." Kiki had looked up with that kind of brightness Naomi's mother would have called making the best of a bad situation. She dropped her mirror into her bag. "And Artie says he's seen the commercial that uses it again. The song from Bread for Sex, during his ball games." Naomi grimaced. She had the nagging impression that what her son really wanted to be was a movie star. All those throwaway celebrities with their facelifts and their Botox, and her son insistent on pushing it a step further, taking those vain clothes horses as role models, but being that much more outrageous. Ridiculous, she would like to add. Her son had always been a show-off. That was nothing new. In school, he had finagled his way into every play and talent show. Then there had been that long, worrisome phase with the ripped T-shirts and paint sprayed in his hair and a string of paper clips strung from earlobe to earlobe. "It's just fashion," he would say, and she had supposed it was. Until he stopped showing up for work at Gabe Sr.'s insulation business, and she had to bail him out of jail for running red lights on Sunset as high as a kite on what have you. The truth was, the truth she didn't admit to anyone because she knew how they would take it. Or not take it, more likely. The truth was that those dark days with him, and there were plenty of them, with the drugs and the stealing and the long, long disappearances when they had no clue where he was or what he might be up to, those days had been easier for her. At least then she had known what she was facing. At least then the world was on her side and recognized that something was wrong and that something could and should be done. Treatment. Prison, even, if that would straighten him out. He could turn his life around while there was still time, make his father proud of him. Because as much as she was dismayed, everything he did hurt Gabe Sr. a little worse. Because there finally came a time, after their son had moved out for good, that he never showed up at their door except when he was in those clothes. And Gabe Sr. just cracked, simply cracked. She thought now of his heart as a piece of good china that over the years had become netted with hairline breaks, so fine you would never see them with the naked eye. But if the coffee were ever hot enough, if you poured it in too quickly, the cup would shatter with no structure left to keep it glued together. Years after Gabe Sr. died, her son came back to the city after a long time away, newly rich from the band's music and full of plans, and they had worked out their current living arrangement. Her son had been looking to buy in the Silver Lake area, which was ridiculous because he could no longer find anything half as nice for 10 times the price, and really, what use did she, one old lady, have for such a big place? But her son said, "Mommy, I can't live with you. It's not going to happen." Said it right to her face. And she didn't see what else she could do besides offer to move down into the converted apartment below the house. And her bluff, if that's what it was called.
I'm Andrew Tonkovich, and you're listening to a special performance edition of Bibliocracy on KPFK, a reading from his novel Wait Here by novelist Greg Bills. Now back to the reading.
When Naomi tuned into the conversation at the table again, Kiki and Sandy were discussing, it seemed, real estate. "Would you sell your house?" Kiki looked dubious. "In this market?" "Of course I would sell it. I would have to." Sandy marshaled a shivery forkful of egg to her lips. "What's wrong with the market?" "Greta says it's soft." Greta was Kiki's oldest, a real estate big shot, supposedly. "A buyer's market. Considering what Frank and I paid, I think that whatever I got for it would seem like a fortune. Still, there's good seasons and there's bad." Kiki spoke with weary authority, as if she really knew what she was talking about. Naomi watched a bee bump its head against the glass top of the partition just behind and beyond Kiki's head. It seemed to be trapped inside the patio, although, with a little enterprise, it could easily fly up a few extra inches and get free. "Mimi, are you still with us?" Sandy had turned in her seat to look directly into her eyes. "Yes, of course." Naomi was aware of her own voice. How vague it sounded. Frankly, the whole direction of their breakfast conversation this week had not been to her liking, and she was happy for the distraction of the little lost insect. "Your son seriously thinks you should be in a nursing home." She was shocked to find that she had spoken this last bit out loud. "It's not a nursing home, Mimi." Sandy, who was generally unflappable, seemed truly offended. "You've heard about Leisure World. It's a huge retirement community, and close to where Ryan lives." Naomi wanted to recover Sandy's good graces after her rudeness. "None of us wants to lose you, is all." "That's sweet of you, Mimi." Sandy touched the back of Naomi's hand with light fingers. "Actually, Ryan had a suggestion about that. We wondered if you might consider joining me down there. We could be roommates." "Roommates?" She struggled to make her voice sound bright, as if she were actually considering the proposal. She hated to think that Sandy only wanted someone with her down in Orange County to care for her and her shakes. "That could be fun, if only I could. I only mention it because you have seemed so unhappy with your living situation lately. What makes you think that?" She fumbled for a triangle of toast to butter. Kiki pointed, rather accusingly, she thought, at Naomi with the knife in her fist. "Now, Mimi, you've done nothing but complain since you moved down into that underground apartment." "It's not underground." "Well, from the way you talk, I've never been a complainer. You both have known me how many years, and have I ever been one to... My point is that you're never too old to deserve to be satisfied with what you have." "I think you made the right choice, though," Sandy added, "in letting Libby take over the upper house. It really was too much for you. Too much to take care of, I mean." Naomi looked down to examine the huge, unappetizingly pale disc of tomato on her plate. Now was one of those times when she could choose to let it go. She knew she should choose to let it slide by unremarked, but she felt the gorge rising in her throat, and the words came up along with it. "I wish you wouldn't call him that." "Oh," Sandy sounded truly startled. "What? I'm sorry, Mimi. I thought Libby Majora was... What name should I use?" "His name," she thought. "You should use his given name." But even she didn't use that very often any longer. Most often she left an empty space, the feeling of tongue and throat tightening up to swallow. "That isn't even a real name. It's made up, a dirty joke, a very poor dirty joke. But..." Sandy stopped herself, obviously stumped. Kiki jumped in. "Everybody has to have a name, don't they? What does she call herself, to his friends? I think you both know how I feel about this." Naomi couldn't wait for the bill to come, for this breakfast to be over. I just wonder if it might be better to go all the way, you know, call him whatever name he chooses, just decide that she's a woman now, use the female words, the whole thing. I don't believe I asked for your advice, Catherine. At this, Kiki and Sandy exchanged glances, the way they did, more and more often, conspiring right in front of her. I'm not being unreasonable. You don't have to agree with it, but what are you going to do about it? All I'm suggesting is it might be easier. I'm not interested in trying to make things easier. If it was your child, you'd know. She felt that her concession, that she wasn't just blind to the truth and hysterical, was there in what she had said. She had used child, not son. You'd know how difficult it is. What her son did, was irrevocable. It's not so simple for me. It's irrevocable. Of course. Sandy trembled towards her tea again. Of course. So he had the surgery then. We sort of assumed, but... She dropped her fork into the runny yolk on her plate. You know what? You know what I think? You people are a little too interested in all this. Eager for the details. You think this is something we can just chat about? Mimi, really? We would never... Sandy clattered her teacup back into its saucer. And Sandy, what is wrong with you? What? All these jitters, this palsy you've got, and you never say anything. Is it that disease Catherine Hepburn had, or what is it? It's old age, Mimi. It's old age. Sandy's voice was flat. It's not Parkinson's, just something in my nervous system. The doctor said I shouldn't worry unless, you know, it interferes. Well, I'm glad to hear that. I did wonder about that. My lord, Mimi, don't pick on Sandy, because you haven't been mean like this, not in years. Mean? Well... She took the ready-folded 20 out of her coin purse and patted it onto the tabletop. I think I will just walk home today. Good morning, then. She squeaked her way awkwardly off of her chair and stood. Kiki looked up at her, whether with a smirk or a frown she couldn't begin to say. Now sit down. Walk? Don't be silly. You can't walk all the way up that hill. I'll get a taxi if I'm tired. Of course you won't. Artie will be here to pick us up any time now, and we can all go. Naomi stood, she noticed, in the path of the approaching waitress, disoriented, still gripping her coin purse. I'll just wait up in the front, then. I need to use the, ladies' room. Sandy laid her napkin beside her plate. Do you want one of us to come with you? You look a little... No. No, I'm fine, really. She waved them off and stumbled for the inside. That night, she had no reason to assume she and her son wouldn't be having their usual Friday night dinner. But her son informed her that there was a party in Santa Monica. Their conversation was conducted in the stairwell, her son at the top, and she herself in the well of light that poured down from the open door above. But we always, she pleaded, embarrassingly, she heard the whimper in her voice, we always had family dinner on the Sabbath. The Sabbath, oh sweet Jesus, her son cackled, he, actually snorting with laughter. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. I think we've been off track with that commandment for a while now. Unless you thought we should light the candles together. You can mock, but when you're older, this will become more meaningful to you, too. Older? How much older do I have to get? Anyway, you've got my number, and we can have dinner tomorrow. I'll go shopping if you want. Make a list. With that, her son shut the door on her, condemned her to the darkness. There was no point in making a big fuss over dinner if it was just herself. Instead, she looked around for something that needed doing, some housekeeping chore that would get the benefit of this unexpected parcel of open time. Her eyes settled on the knick-knack shelf on the wall beyond the kitchen table, and she hunted under the sink for the end dust and an old sock. She lifted each object on the shelf and dusted the dark wood beneath it before she began the more complicated task of dusting the objects themselves. There were little this and that's she had saved for whatever reason and had become attached to. Near the center, paired with a careworn Stiff teddy bear, it had been Gabe Sr.'s, was the donkey they had gotten at the Grand Canyon. The family had taken a car trip when their son was only 4, and they had bought this curio in a gift shop at the North Rim. It was meant to look like the donkeys that people would ride down to the floor of the canyon. Its body was just hard plastic, but it had been flocked with some brown substance that felt like crumbling velvet. When she and her son were unpacking these treasures, she had held up the burrow, is what they had called them, and told her son how they had picked this out. "Oh, I remember," her son said. "I was there. I desperately wanted the Indian girl in the leather dress, with the moccasins and the little necklaces of turquoise beads. But you took her out of my hands and gave me the burrow. If it had a little fighter plane or a little gun that said Grand Canyon on it, I'm sure you would have bought me that instead. Of course her son made the memory into something to accuse them. That was how it always went. She set the burrow back onto his spot, turned his head a fraction so that his happy face looked out at the room. From her memory of what her son had said, it wasn't the griping that held her attention this time. It was the other part, that little statement, "I was there." Of course her son had been there. The three of them had stood before the shelves of polished stones and odd slices of polished wood with postcard images of the canyon varnished onto each, and medallion keychains and plastic tomahawks. But she wondered if her son had meant to argue against the very feeling she was having now. That little boy who had come to her only after so much effort. That boy had joined them briefly and then had gone. And she supposed every parent felt that loss. Tiny hands grown larger than your own. Little mops of hair grown out and cut short and grown out again over so many years. Small perfect faces stretched and made handsome or ugly, but chiefly made older. And older and older until the little boy was gone, recognizable perhaps in the turn of a smile or the shell of an ear, but found no more on this earth. Every mother must have that experience, that tiny nameless grief that wasn't caused by death, but by simple time. But for her, the loss was more profound. Her little boy had no one to carry on his name, no adult body to carry him inside like a dreaming egg. That little boy was good and truly gone. At least that was what she felt sometimes. And was that the point where her son disagreed? I was there. Was her son now, truly there? Was calling this new person her son even correct these days? She shook out the teddy bear, checking for dust, and patted it down with a sock. Of its former owner, there was no question. Gabe Sr. was gone. Her husband. Her first and only real love. A love as present as the person who lived upstairs. If she had known she was raising a girl, would she have done anything differently? Would she? But she hadn't raised a girl. She couldn't, not wouldn't, but couldn't, think about it that way. She had raised her son, and when she had looked from the threshold to his single bed, when she had seen him playing Rumpelstiltskin in that elementary school play, how he had delighted in stamping his feet and shouting, "Fiddlesticks!" When she handed him and Gabe Sr. their lunches before they walked to the car together, carrying their fresh-washed coveralls for work, she had always also seen the face of that little boy in the gift shop, looking bright-eyed into those dull rocks that had been split open to show their nests of crystal inside. She had also seen, like a shadow, a spirit, like the after-image left from a bright sudden light, Gabe Sr. reflected there in her son's expressions, in the very substance of his flesh, a glint, just a glint, of her husband. And now when she looked, when she dared to look, and how often, even when they ate together, did she stare out in her son's direction without actually allowing her gaze to land? She saw this other person, this woman, almost already old, garish and tasteless and slutty, and she wondered, where was her son? Where was her husband? She had lost them both, and worse, it almost seemed that she had lost her husband twice. She looked down at her hand, cocooned stupidly in the dirt-smeared sock. She no longer knew how to look into her son's face and find the past she thought she had safely secreted there.